Did you hear about the recent landmark decision in the UK where a law has finally been passed after much careful deliberation and consultation that will allow so-called three-parent babies, that is, babies with three genetic parents? How does that work?
The eyes to the right, 382. The nose to the left, 128.
An impressive win for researchers and campaigners, a conscience vote firmly in favour of the world-first technique. In a passionate debate in the Commons, Public Health Minister Jane Ellison urged MPs to pass the laws.
This is a bold step for Parliament to take, but it is a considered and informed step. Hear, hear. This is world-leading science within a highly respected regulatory regime. Hear, hear. And for the many families affected, this is light at the end of a very dark tunnel. Yeah,
yeah. And that very dark tunnel is the experience of devastating and potentially fatal mitochondrial diseases, as they're called. Just to explain, and we'll hear more about this, in the nucleus of our cells we have DNA wrapped up in our chromosomes, which determines most of our physical traits. But within our cells, you might know that we also have mitochondrial DNA inherited from our mothers. High school biology would have taught you about the mitochondria being the powerhouse of our cells, the battery pack of our bodies, if you like. It is vital. But mitochondrial DNA can also carry specific disease-causing mutations. And with this new IVF technique that's been approved in the UK, women carriers of these mutations on their mitochondrial DNA who want to have kids could have that DNA replaced with a donor's in an embryo. That's a sort of summary of the procedure. It's great news for those who want to see an end to nasty mitochondrial disorders, but will Australia follow suit and allow this procedure? Some are concerned about its safety and don't think it's ready for widespread use in humans. Joining us shortly, a legal scholar specialising in bioethics. But first, let me introduce Professor Justin St. John. He's director of the Centre for Genetic Diseases at Monash Prince Henry's Institute of Medical Research. Welcome to you, Justin.
Good morning, Sasha.
And we also have with us Sean Murray. He is CEO of the Australian Mitochondrial Foundation. They're a not-for-profit patient advocacy and research group. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
Sean, your foundation, in fact, lobbied the UK in support of this procedure as they were going through their deliberations, I gather. Just outline in a little bit more detail what this procedure is.
Well, in simplistic terms, what we're talking about is at an embryonic stage or at the stage of creation of a child, replacing a potential patient's faulty mitochondria that would be passed on to their child, replacing that with healthy mitochondria to try to avert passing on mitochondrial disease to that child. So we're talking about a transplant is one term that's used here, not something akin to an organ transplant in a human, but at an embryonic stage in a cell, we're talking about transferring unhealthy mitochondria with healthy mitochondria to avoid the passing on of that disease.
But you'd still take the DNA from the nucleus of the parents. Those germlines would be intact.
Well, actually, the germline is contained within the mitochondrial DNA, and I think that's probably something that Justin could talk a little more about with command. But when you're absolutely right, the nuclear DNA, which is the vast majority of our DNA, and as you mentioned, defines our characteristics, our hair colour, our eye colour, etc. I think it's something like 99.9% of the DNA is in the nuclear. In the nucleus, and this mitochondria is separate to the nucleus of the cell. They float around in the cell there, and they do contain a very small trace of their own DNA, and it's that DNA in particular that we're talking about here that can be life-threatening and cause horrible diseases.
Describe how horrible they can be. What is life like if you're diagnosed with a mitochondrial disease? And it's actually a suite of diseases, is it not?
You're exactly right, because there are hundreds of causes of mitochondrial diseases, the causes being different mutations in different genes in both the nuclear DNA and or the mitochondrial DNA. So what we're talking about here is a group of those, those caused by changes in the mitochondrial DNA. Because we have mitochondria in, let's just say, every cell of our body, there are a few exceptions, but every cell of your body has mitochondria, and their job is to provide They're the energy factories, they're the power plants, they convert the food we eat into that energy source that our cells use to fuel them to do their job. So when that process is broken down or isn't working properly, the cells are starved of that energy and they can't function. Those cells can die, and the organ system or the body system that they're a part of can start to fail. So because they're everywhere, unfortunately, mitochondrial disease can cause symptoms in any part of our body.
Mm.
And what we'll see with patients with a chronic form of mitochondrial disease will probably have symptoms in multiple organ systems of their body. So we have patients who have things with problems with their brain, because our brain uses a lot of energy, our eyes, our ears, our guts, our heart, our muscles, big muscle systems. So you're talking about something that's impacting a patient in a horrible way, and it can affect anybody at any age.
But still, a small population of people.
Well, absolutely. It was first thought to be a very rare disease. Mitochondrial disease has only been diagnosed since the 1980s and then properly in the 1990s. We're learning more about it every day, but we thought it was extremely rare back then, but we know now that it's more common than was first thought. We know that there's one child born in Australia every week that will develop a life-threatening form of mitochondrial disease.
And it's actually quite hard to diagnose, isn't it? And this is intensely personal to you. You know how hard it is to diagnose. Your brother had this experience?
That's right, and my mother and my grandmother. So, and we only know about that retrospectively. We certainly didn't know about it generations ago.
So how did symptoms present?
Well, in my family, it started with adult onset hearing loss that was quite rapid, and it was different in one ear at a time. But then my brother presented at the age of 35 with what was thought to be a stroke. And so for an otherwise fit and healthy young man to have a stroke, it was very strange. And he ended up just in the right place with somebody who knew about mitochondrial disease, who started to probe the family history and started to see that my mother had some similar symptoms, my maternal grandmother had symptoms as well, and then they were able to make that diagnosis. In our case, it was fairly swift, really, but it's certainly not the case for most patients.
So why have you been lobbying so actively another country to legalise this procedure that has been developed?
Well, we think that the mitochondrial disease community deserves hope, and this is certainly what you mentioned before, that light of this very long, very dark tunnel. We think it's important not only for the community, but it's assuming that safety and efficacy can be proven, we know that the patient community deserve hope in this regard. So that's our intent there.
Okay, thank you very much, Sean, for sharing some of your personal story too. Let me come to Professor Justin St. John, Director of the Centre for Genetic Diseases at Monash Prince Henry's Institute of Medical Research. In fact, you have urged caution, Justin, about this decision in the UK. What are your concerns as a scientist, as a genetic researcher?
So let me say first off, Natasha, that I'm very keen that this technology is advanced, but my concerns are based around the actual transfer process itself. So when the egg is fertilized with the mother, with sperm from the father, the new chromosome will set is transferred into another egg. My concerns are that the package which is transferred from one egg to another will carry some defective mitochondrial DNA across. And the problem is that we don't know whether the defective mitochondrial DNA will be selected for or against. We know from other technologies, which are very similar to the one proposed, that the offspring can inherit none or a large amount of its overall content can arise from the mitochondrial DNA that is carried across.
So, in fact, the procedure itself might not produce the results that it's hoping to. In other words, preventing mutated mitochondrial DNA being transferred to the offspring.
That is a possibility. That won't be the case for all situations, but it would be for some. And I think it's important that we iron out some of these problems before we start to introduce this into clinical medicine.
But you can understand that families who are affected by mitochondrial diseases are very keen to have this procedure available now.
Well, I understand that fully, but I think that we have the onus is on us to provide them with a therapy that is absolutely safe and isn't going to cause them the problems which they're already trying to alleviate.
Yeah. What sorts of studies or clinical trials have been conducted that have prompted the decision in the UK? You know, this is a, have there been full human clinical trials, for example?
No, so far, majority of studies have been carried out in monkeys where there's been shown that there has been some carryover and that the offspring inherited a small amount of the defective mitochondrial DNA. But what was interesting is that in that particular monkey study, when there was a large amount of defective mitochondrial DNA that was passed to the offspring, it actually went into the germline, into the eggs of the subsequent generation. So that would ensure that the disease would be propagated from one generation to the next. There have also been some studies carried out using human embryos, and these have been embryos have been developed to the last stage of pre-implantation development. So that's before the embryo has the power to implant in the female womb. And it's been shown that there is some defective mitochondrial DNA that is carried over. But what we don't know is how much of that defective mitochondrial DNA will actually contribute to the offspring. So we know from some technologies, for example, that when you do the transfer in large animal models, that actually the offspring can its total mitochondrial DNA content consists of anything from 0 to 60% of the mitochondrial DNA that's been carried over.
Why do you think that this procedure has been approved on this basis? Surely many of your colleagues in the genetics arena will have advised this decision in the UK.
Yeah, so I think the way the process was set up in the UK was done in a manner where a specific question was asked. And the government, the Minister for Health, asked the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority to investigate whether the new technique that's been proposed would improve the outcome when compared to the other technologies that are available. And based on the small human study that's been done and the monkey studies, the thoughts were that actually it would be an improvement. Current technologies rely on using what's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where you would make a normal embryo in an IVF laboratory, and then you would suck out one of the cells and examine that. And it's quite clear from that that those embryos can have a large amount of defective mitochondrial DNA. So in terms of the regulatory authorities in the UK, their feelings are that the technology offers an improvement. And the Human Fertilization Authority was asked specifically to state whether it would offer an improvement on current treatment options that were available. So it was a very finite question that was asked, as opposed to a complete evaluation of the whole processes and the large-scale offspring outcomes for the offspring.
Professor Justin St. John is with us, Director of the Centre for Genetic Diseases at Monash Prince Henry's Institute of Medical Research, as is Sean Murray, CEO of the Australian Mitochondrial Foundation. I'm going to introduce a third guest in just a moment. But we are discussing a ruling, a landmark decision in the UK, where a law has been passed after much consultation that will allow the genetic material from three parents to be used in a special IVF procedure to produce a baby to eliminate mitochondrial diseases or the risk of mitochondrial diseases in that baby. But as we're hearing, the procedure might not be quite baked yet. Sean, that must cause you some concern, really, that if it's not guaranteed to work, why use it at this early stage? Surely more clinical trials.
Look, you're absolutely right. Aspiring for absolute certainty in any medical procedure, I think, is something that we can't do. At no stage has any current medical treatment, any drug, any advancement in medicine guaranteed absolute certainty before its introduction. There is always an inherent level of risk associated with any new and unproven technology. Now, this is where the Australian Mitochondrial Disease Foundation is trying to force an agenda here, not only with our contribution to the consultation in the UK, but with the government here in Australia, where legislation not only restricts this potential offering in a therapeutic sense, but in a research environment as well. Australian researchers are restricted by law from conducting scientific research in this area as well. So Professor Justin St. John's work is hampered, I believe, by this as well. So we think that absolutely we want to make sure that we've done the best that can be done to guarantee and, or not guarantee, but to make sure it's the highest chance of success. But I think aspiring for absolute certainty in any regard is unattainable.
But given long-term studies haven't tracked children born from this procedure, then you're at risk of creating a generation of guinea pigs who are born via this procedure.
That's correct. And I think the same would be said for when we look back at IVF techniques, that when they were originally introduced, we're in a similar situation. Now, let's go back to the process was extremely consultative and exhaustive. I don't know that what was being referenced to this, the framework of the discussion, and it's in its simplistic terms. From my understanding, this is an 8-year process that involved numerous consultations, numerous scientific input, etc. And the overwhelming opinion was that these risks were far outweighed by the benefits, the prospective benefits.
Let's bring into the conversation Professor Loane Skene from the University of Melbourne's Faculty of Law, an adjunct professor in the medical faculty as well. She's a member of the NH and MRC's Australian Health Ethics Committee. She served on the two major federal committees on human cloning and embryo research. She's well across bioethics and the law, that nexus here in Australia. Welcome to the show, Loane.
Thanks, Natasha. Hello, everyone.
What does Australian law, and Sean alluded to it, say about procedures like this one that we are discussing? Are we thinking about whether Australia will follow suit? The scientific evidence is one question that we've been discussing. What about the legal situation?
Yes, it's open to interpretation, Natasha, because it's not entirely clear. We have two acts. One of them creates offences, and one of them allows research to be undertaken, provided that it's approved by the NHMRC Embryo Licensing Committee. So thinking about the creation of this embryo for the purpose of preventing the transmission of mitochondrial disease, if there is one embryo created and then a second one created, and material is removed from one and transferred to the other, that would appear not to be unlawful under the current Victorian legislation.
So you've got a scenario where you've got and this is one version of this technique,
that's
where you
right.
have a donor embryo created by a couple, and you have a recipient embryo created by a couple, and there's a transfer of material between the two.
Yes, the healthy mitochondria. If this happens, this would appear not to be prohibited by the Prohibition of Human Cloning for Reproduction Act, because what that prohibits is the creation of an embryo.
Have we got you? Crummy old phone line there. Just see if you can move to another spot.
Right, I'm sorry.
Gotcha.
About this.
We've got you
yep.
there. We've got you.
Okay, thank you. So if you don't create an embryo by the process of fertilisation, fertilising a woman's egg with a man's sperm, and you create an embryo for the purpose of preventing the transmission of mitochondrial disease by some other way, then that isn't prohibited by the Act.
So theoretically, we could approve this procedure in Australia under existing legislation?
We could approve the research in the early stages, not to create a baby for the purpose of, by transferring the embryo to the uterus of a woman, so it would only be for research, and the research would have to be submitted to the NHMRC Embryo Licensing Committee for approval.
What would allow, and we should just explain that Loane is in the country at the moment, so hence the poor mobile coverage, and some of you listening would go, yes, we know about that, living with that experience yourself, wherever you live. But for a mother who wanted to have a child who is from a family who is at risk of mitochondrial disease, that wouldn't be allowed to happen. She wouldn't be able to access this procedure under existing law.
Not under existing law, Natasha, no. For the sort of reasons that have been described, particularly by Justin, that you're doing a very risky procedure where we don't know the outcome. And if you're doing it to create a child, you then have a child who is going to live their whole life and possibly pass on to the next generation changes that you wouldn't want to be passing on. So it's an area where we have to be particularly careful in proceeding to therapeutic uses of this technology.
And yet the UK has proceeded.
Yes, they have. They've passed the legislation. It doesn't necessarily mean that this will ever happen. Some time ago, the UK passed legislation allowing embryos to be created that included animal DNA. And the legislation was hotly debated in both Houses of Parliament, particularly the House of Lords, and the legislation was passed, but the research has never been done. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll move to the next step. But the fact that we have this sort of technology available does mean that we should be starting to look again at the legislation and thinking whether we should change it to allow at least more research to be done.
Do you think we should?
I think that there are great arguments for doing it. I think we should proceed very slowly with regard to human patients. But if we do the research and we keep doing the research and we have promising results, it is true that at some point somebody will have to be the first person to try it out.
Justin St. John, do you see ethical concerns in relation to this technique? I mean, certainly if we're using two embryos to create one child, some might be concerned about that from an ethical standpoint, that one embryo is being sacrificed, or two embryos are being used, one ultimately is being sacrificed.
Yeah, so I can understand that there would be a large number of people who would be concerned about this, but I think the gains would outweigh the negatives here, that we would actually be in, if this technology really does work, we would be in a position to prevent the transmission of this very horrible disease. And I think from a scientist's point of view, we actually have a moral obligation to ensure that we can provide the best possible technology that's available. And if we can prevent these diseases from being transmitted, then that's a major step forward and a responsibility that we as scientists have to take on board.
Sean Murray, have you lobbied the Australian government on this issue?
Yes, we have. We've certainly developed our position and a well-considered position in this regard and communicated that with the various health ministers over the past 6 or so years since we've been established. And it's something now that we would certainly call on the government in Australia to look at what's happening, look very closely at what's happening in the UK and consider our position here. And we agree that this could be a catalyst for us to review our current stance in this regard.
Is it right to use the phrase three-parent baby as is being used in the media?
Look, our position is that that's a somewhat a sensationalist label. It's certainly attracting attention, which on one hand, for our cause, this otherwise unknown cause, is quite good. Our position is, if you look at the amount of genetic material that we're talking about here, 99.9% of our DNA comes from the nucleus of our cell. That's the DNA that most people think about when they think about genes. It defines our hair colour, our eye colour, all that sort of thing. This mitochondrial DNA that comes, yes, from a third person, from a donor, much akin to an organ transplant in a patient with heart disease, etc.
Is a very small component.
Is a very small component.
So it's two parents plus an extra little bit.
Yeah, 2.02 parents, perhaps.
Okay. Look, it's a complex terrain, and I thank you. I had more questions for Lo and you, but the phone line is a little bit bodgy. But look, great to have you all to talk this through. Professor Lowenstein, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Natasha.
From the Faculty of Law and also an adjunct professor in the Medical Faculty at the University of Melbourne, Professor Justin St. John from the Centre for Genetic Diseases at Monash Prince Henry's Institute of Medical Research. Thank you, Justin.
Thank you, Natasha.
Very much. And Sean Murray, CEO of the Australian Mitochondrial Foundation. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Yes, lots there to talk about, and perhaps you are part of a family who's been affected, like Sean's, by mitochondrial diseases, and you are listening very acutely to this conversation. But it does raise all sorts of interesting questions, doesn't it, about the future of reproductive technologies. Natasha Mitchell with you here on Life Matters, where we often talk about reproductive technologies and the cutting edge there. Coming up, reproductive technologies of a different kind. She's breeding goats and chicks and lambs, and there's a llama in the mix there too, I think. Coming up.